You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, folks. Before we start the show, I want to ask for your help. If you enjoy Kick-Ass Politics, I hope you'll help us reach our goal of raising our full production budget for 2016 by donating on our website at kickasspolitics.com or at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. Thanks for listening, and now enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass Politics. My guest today is the only person in U.S. history to have served as both the head of the CIA and the head of the NSA. Four-star General Michael Hayden served in the U.S. Air Force for over 40 years in various senior staff positions at the Pentagon, U.S. European Command, and the National Security Council. He also served as commander of the Air Intelligence Agency and director of Joint Command and Control Warfare Center, as well as deputy chief of staff for the United Nations Command and U.S. Forces Korea Command. In 1999, President Bill Clinton appointed Michael Hayden as director of the National Security Agency, where he implemented a dramatic overhaul and expansion of the agency in the wake of the 9/11 terror attacks. Then, from 2005 to 2006, he served as the very first principal deputy director of national intelligence. Finally, in May of 2006, President George W. Bush appointed General Michael Hayden director of the Central Intelligence Agency, where he remained as director until retiring from government service in February 2009. Today, Michael Hayden is a principal at the Chertoff Group, a security consulting firm co-founded by former Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, and he also serves as a distinguished visiting professor at the George Mason University School of Public Policy. On today's podcast, he'll give a frank assessment of the intelligence failures leading up to 9/11 and what he did as NSA director and later as the head of the CIA to close those intelligence gaps. We'll discuss the conundrums of domestic surveillance, CIA black sites, and enhanced interrogation. We'll also talk about cyber warfare, the Apple encryption controversy, and the personal toll of keeping America's secrets. Plus, he'll talk about why the U.S. military may be obligated to reject orders from a President Donald Trump, and whether he prefers his vodka martini shaken or stirred. Coming up with General Michael Hayden in just a moment.
From Hollywood to Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
My guest today is former director of the NSA, deputy director of national intelligence, and former director of the CIA, General Michael Hayden. He has a new book called Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. General Michael Hayden, thanks for sitting down with me.
Oh, thank you very much, Ben. Happy to be here.
If I ask you something that's classified or you can't discuss, feel free to kick me under the table.
Okay.
Here, okay? The book is really interesting. I think it's about as detailed a picture of the U.S. intelligence apparatus as I've probably read, or as detailed as one can disclose, I suppose. Briefly explain the title of the book, because it sums up your whole philosophy.
It is. And actually, I didn't have a title. I had a manuscript, you know, the 85% solution, still needed a little work. And I went to my wife and said, "You've kind of looked over my shoulder while I'm doing this. What do you think we should call it?" And she actually said, "Playing to the Edge." And then I put the colon in and American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. And she knew what animated me while I was director of those agencies, which was to play hard, was to take the full authorities we had been given, you know, when the circumstances warranted it, Ben, to go all the way out to the line. The way I put it, and I mentioned this in the book, I knew playing out to the line was going to lead to some uncomfortable congressional hearings someday, maybe some uncomfortable press coverage someday. I mean, the American public is a little fickle about their intelligence services, right? But I also knew that if I played back from that line, I might be protecting me, but I wasn't protecting the country.
Yeah.
And so I did want to play to the line. And in fact, when I decided to write the book, Ben, as you suggest, that was kind of an underlying theme. I don't think this is a mean-spirited book. You know, it's not a kiss-and-tell book, but it's not apologetic either. And that's why the title fits very well.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, you know, I think my biggest takeaway, not to sound cynical, but my biggest takeaway from the book might be what a thankless job it is protecting America. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems that, you know, if you're in the intelligence game, you're either damned if you do or you're damned if you don't.
Well, the existential whine we have, and that's whine, is that American political elites, not average Americans, but American political elites, feel free to criticize their espionage services for not doing enough when they feel in danger. And then to turn on the dime and criticize them for doing too much once they've been made to feel safe again.
You have no love for politicians in Congress, or many politicians in
well,
Congress in this book.
You know, I'm kind of candid, and then again, it's my point of view, and I was off put by what I viewed was inconsistency from time to time. But I said this last night to another group. You know, nobody gets a road built in the district back home, or a bridge resurfaced or built for being on the Intel Committee.
And that's
so,
a good point.
So those are very serious people, but our political pressures are such, and our political system so fractured, Ben, that an area of activity which used to be kind of the temple of bipartisanship has become very partisan. And that's kind of what I was trying to reflect.
Well, yeah, and politicians basically have the luxury of being able to play both sides of the fence on this.
Well, they do. And you know what? And I mentioned this in the book, too. We give them the ability to do that when we don't bring them in richly enough or early enough. I'm 39 years an airman. And one of the phrases we have in the Air Force is, if you want people to be with you at the crash, you got to put them on the manifest.
Yeah. Oh, so, I like it. And so you got to take away plausible deniability, huh?
Well, there's a theme in here that people in my position want Congress to know as fully and as early as possible. I mean, this is a bad metaphor, but it's the political get out of jail free card.
Yeah.
In other words, if a Congress member is going to object, make them object when everyone's frightened. Make them object when people don't know the future. Make them object when you've got tough choices to make, not afterwards, 3, 5, or 7 years after you've had to make the hard calls.
Yeah, yeah, because that makes it a lot harder for them to come Monday morning quarterbacking like Claude Rains in Casablanca saying, I'm shocked that we've been listening to...
well, blessedly, that's not a frequent occurrence, but I do mention some examples.
Let's talk about 9/11, because that's where a lot of this begins. You were at the NSA probably during the most interesting period in its history, and you were witness to the dysfunction leading up to 9/11, and you were in charge of essentially rebuilding it. I'm not so interested in combing over the failures because I think those have been hashed over plenty of times at this point. But what were the most important and effective changes that NSA and the broader intelligence community made in the wake of that failure?
Okay, so you're talking about the failure of 9/11.
Yeah.
Okay. So we knew at NSA that we were falling behind. And I actually regret it, but chapter two in the book is fairly bureaucratic. I try to make it interesting. All right. But it's a bureaucratic transformation of NSA. But you can't understand what happened on 9/11 if you don't have a sense of what we're trying to do before 9/11. And Ben, I think the point you're suggesting is we knew a lot of the things that we accelerated change on after 9/11, we knew before, and it already started it. So what we got from 9/11, Ben, what was actually there's a passage in the book where I pull the leadership in at NSA within weeks of the attack. I said, look, we've been doing transformation here now for about a year. Do we need to change something? And in the book, it says very clearly, the consensus I got from my leadership was change nothing, accelerate everything. And so what we got after 9/11, number one, was that sense of urgency that it didn't matter that we were breaking old China. We had to move forward. And then, Ben, to be perfectly candid, we got lots of money. and that makes change easier.
Yeah, definitely. Talking about 9/11, given that it took 10 years for us to find Osama bin Laden, at least to many people, it appeared that he was hiding in plain sight. Is it fair to say that? Would you consider that it was at least a partial intelligence failure?
You know, there's a passage in the book where I talk about CIA analysis. Mm-hmm. And I get asked the question, General, on a scale of 0 to 10, how would you rate CIA analysis? And I paused. There's a bunch of civilians that was asking me, civilians, asking me the question. And I paused before answering. And then, Ben, I said, well, the first thing you got to understand, we don't do 8, 9, and 10. If you can get something to 8, 9, or 10, they're not asking us the question. That's being chucked down the street to the Department of Commerce or something. And so these are very, very hard issues. Now, to get to your point about bin Laden, when I learned he was at Abbottabad, I was surprised. Our assumption had been he would be in the most remote areas possible.
Right.
And now here it is, you have him living in a mid-sized Pakistani town, less than a mile from their equivalent of West Point. And so I must admit that was a bit surprising. But you know, I was going over my notes for actually doing research for the book. And I'm going through these boxes of things that the agency CIA had kept for me. And I came across my notes for a briefing I gave President Bush in December of 2008. And in those notes, I had my people telling me that we were doing pretty well tracking down this guy we thought might lead us to bin Laden, this guy named Ahmed al-Kuwaiti. And I was first briefed on chasing the courier late 07, early 08, and the way I describe it is from that point on, not one brick at a time, but one grain at a time, we then began to build the line that finally took us to Abbottabad.
Wow. So that was about a 3-year process.
Oh,
then.
Yeah. Look, we were looking for him all the time.
Right, right.
And we tried multiple approaches.
But when you had your first decent
lead. But late 07, early 08, they came into me and said, we're going to put our energies into tracking the courier. And the rest is kind of history.
Yeah. Well, you know, it brings up an interesting point because in the era where you're not fighting against an organized state with easily identifiable agents, how in an ocean of people, I mean, you can talk domestic surveillance here in America or just abroad, how in an ocean of people do you even begin to know who you want to target for surveillance?
Ben, you are bringing up the fundamental tectonic shift in terms of the challenge that American intelligence has. You're absolutely right. I'm old enough to remember when all the pieces on the board were nation states. And now, because of the world we live in, because of the empowerment of individuals and groups, the interconnectivity of practically everyone on the planet, we now, Ben, have groups, gangs, and even individuals who can actually create evil effects against us. Evil effects we used to associate only with malevolent nation states. Yeah. And so we've had to turn and go after this new kind of actor. And Ben, that's not just a technological problem. that's a political policy and legal issue too. I mean, look, look, I can't find a civil libertarian who raised his little finger over NSA intercepting Soviet strategic rocket forces, command and control networks. All right.
Yeah.
But the 21st century equivalent of that are Al-Qaeda or ISIS or proliferator emails sitting out there on the web with your emails and mine.
Yeah.
So you've got not just the technological challenge of finding them, you've got these legal and policy issues. I mean, you go to the American people and, I mean, you don't mind that I'm fishing in the same stream where your stuff is, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you can't cast a broad net, then how do you even begin to know how to narrow it down
to real
possibilities?
Ben, thanks. And that's what I try to explain in the book. I actually point out that the things we started after 9/11, you know, these weren't things sitting in the lower right-hand desk drawer of the director of NSA, you know, waiting for something bad to happen so he could spring them on the American people. They were logical response, controversial, I get it, but logical responses to the new demands that we had in front of us.
But one of the most controversial aspects of this has been the so-called domestic surveillance. In the book, you attempt to clear up some misperceptions about domestic surveillance programs. Can you dispel some of those right now?
Sure. I mean, number one, it was indeed a logical response to the new problem we had. Ben, for two centuries, we had tried to preserve both our security and our liberty by kind of putting foreign stuff over on one side and domestic stuff over on this side, intelligence stuff over here, law enforcement over there. And on 9/11, those 19 hijackers drove through that seam between foreign and domestic law enforcement and intelligence. And so the requirement we had was, how do you fix that seam without doing something that genuinely endangers American liberty and privacy? And the terrorist surveillance program was our best answer at responding to that. And one of the things we did was, no fooling. We had the phone companies give us the metadata of calls within, to, and from the United States, so that we had this pool of data that we could query when we had what we called a dirty phone number, Ben. Mm-hmm. We call it the seed number. So picture, if you will, we raid a safe house in Yemen, and we grab a guy whose pocket litter tells us, oh yeah, this is a bad man. And he's got a cell phone on him that we've never seen before. What we wanted to simply do was to kind of go to that ocean of data, and I fully admit it was an ocean, to go to that database, the terrorist surveillance program database, and kind of figuratively yell through the transom, say, hey, anybody here talk to this phone? And if a number in the Bronx kind of raised its hand and said, well, yeah, I talk to him every Thursday.
Yeah.
NSA then gets to say, well, who do you talk to? Ben, I'm done explaining the metadata program. There was nothing more done to that data. And at that point, with that lead information, you turned it over to the FBI, who then used their authorities if they thought there was anything more to be done.
So it was just basically what you were doing is you were identifying the people, who was talking to who and where they were. You weren't actually reading texts or listening to phone calls.
No, there were other parts.
The FBI was, probably.
There were other parts of the program that allowed us to intercept international calls. Mm-hmm. And so this could be terrorist calls, both ends of which were in the United States. I'm sorry, both ends of which were abroad, or one end of which was in the United States. And indeed, Ben, without a warrant, NSA did intercept the content of those calls, but we already had reason to believe that one or both numbers were already associated with Al-Qaeda. And frankly, Ben, that was never controversial. Everyone understands that met the reasonableness standard of the Fourth Amendment.
Well, yeah, I guess the biggest fear that people have is that it creates a precedent that can be used more broadly.
And I get that, all right?
Yeah.
I get that. I just told you what happened to that ocean of metadata, right? Yeah. And so to my mind, I should calm down all 330 million of us. But there are an awful lot of people out there, and I mean serious, good people, who actually have a legitimate interest in liberty and security, who come to the same conclusion you did, which is, okay, Hayden, I get it. You didn't abuse it. It was used for just the very purpose you said it was used for. By the way, that's true, and no one's challenged that. But you know what? I'm just not comfortable with any government, even my own, having that data because there is a potential for abuse. I get that one. That is a legitimate concern.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll talk about the Apple encryption controversy, cyber warfare, Guantanamo Bay, and why the idea of Donald Trump as president concerns General Michael Hayden. When we come back in just a minute. If you're enjoying my conversation with General Michael Hayden, then you should read his new book, Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. And right now, you can download the audio version of his book for free with a special promotion for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be Playing to the Edge by my guest today, General Michael Hayden, or any of Audible's 180,000 titles for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, iPad, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. We're back, and I'm talking with former director of the CIA and the NSA, General Michael Hayden. Well, General Hayden, I have to tell you, when I was reading Playing to the Edge, I found myself at times a little bit caught off guard. Given the fact that you're coming from the intelligence community, you take some surprising positions that people probably wouldn't have expected when it comes to balancing liberty and being able to protect America. I'd be very curious along these lines to have you weigh in on the Apple controversy.
Yeah.
Should they give the FBI access to the phone records of the San Bernardino shooter?
So here's what I've been saying, and in my personal email account has been lighting up about this. Okay. but I'm trending Apple.
Oh, right? Really?
I am. And hear me out. Okay.
Interesting.
I haven't gone over to any dark side for people with whom I used to work with. Look, I actually think, look, you can argue this, Ben. You can argue this on constitutional grounds. Does the government have a right to demand this? And that's an interesting argument, but I'm no expert on that. You could argue it on privacy grounds. And I'm interested in my privacy, but I'm not a privacy expert. I'm giving you an answer on security grounds.
Okay.
Through the lens of security, I think America is a safer, more secure place with unbreakable end-to-end encryption. And if what the government is asking Apple to do degrades what I just described,
okay,
then I'm with Apple.
Interesting. Now, when you say it degrades end-to-end
right.
encryption.
Here's how I describe it. All right.
So who would we want to worry about that?
Anybody. Look, okay. Jim Clapper is the director of national intelligence, right? Mm-hmm. Jim, for the last 2 or 3 years, Ben, has actually said the most serious threat to American security right now is the cyber threat. All right. So now you've got American industry really going high end on encryption. All right. Picture it as a wall. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and since you want to make American communication secure, a wall is a good thing. Now you've got the FBI, for really good reasons, very legitimate reasons, wanting to create the euphemism we use as exceptional access or extraordinary access. I'm going to call it a door or a window, okay, that allows them and only them to get through the wall. Here's the way I describe it, Ben. I don't care how good a lock. I don't care how many locks. I don't care who has control of the key. I don't care if you have to have multiple keys. I don't care if you have to go to a court to use any of the keys. That door is not a wall.
Yeah.
And when I was the director of the National Security Agency, and someone else had created exceptional or extraordinary access through an encryption system, my first response was, thank you, Lord, because you've just made my job easier.
Yeah.
And so I fear that what the Bureau is asking, and a lot of technicians agree with me, but this is something still to be decided. I fear what the Bureau is asking actually makes that encryption less of a wall than it would otherwise be.
Interesting. So if we create a door, figuratively for America's use, it may not just be America that can then take advantage of that
it
door.
It creates a vulnerability that other high-end governments certainly and maybe even criminal gangs might be able to exploit. Wow. So look, this is the warp and woof of the book, Ben.
Yeah.
It's, hey, these aren't easy choices.
Yeah,
you're,
that's for sure.
So here
that's
I am. Here I am, not in the constitutional lane, not in the privacy security lane. I'm just in the security lane.
Yeah.
Saying this is hard to balance because you know I've got a cyber threat, I've got a terrorist threat, I've got a criminal threat, and I guess what I'm saying is, be careful that in pursuing legitimate ends for the terrorist and the criminal threat, you don't do something you regret over here that makes you more vulnerable to the cyber threat.
Yeah. Let's talk about the cyber war then. Are we losing the cyber war arms race at this point?
We're very good at it. The greatest concentration of cyber power on this planet is at the confluence of the Baltimore-Washington Parkway and Maryland Route 32. It's called Fort George G. Meade. That said, Ben, we have not yet developed the political and policy consensus for what it is we want our government to do in this new domain. Mm-hmm. We are very powerful, but we don't have the policy and legal framework that would allow Mike Rogers, who's now the commander of U.S. Cyber Command, to do all the things he's technologically capable of doing. The line I use is, we have not yet decided, and I mean we, 330 million we, have not yet decided what it is we want or what it is we will allow our government to do to keep us safe in the cyberspace. And Ben, this plays back to the previous question. Because of that, we are going to have to rely on the private sector for security in the cyber domain more than we've become accustomed to relying on the private sector for security in the physical domain since the closing of the American frontier. And now we've got the government maybe asking the private sector to do something that makes them less capable of providing that cybersecurity. Do you see how it comes full circle?
Probably it seems to me the biggest advantage China has is that they have an army of hackers.
Yes.
They can catch the best hackers, pretty much put a gun to their head and say, you're working for us now. Now, are we at a disadvantage here in America because we have to actually hire people on their own free will?
No, we have a disadvantage because we have a different definition of what constitutes lawful state espionage.
Okay.
So, I've actually said this to a Chinese counterpart. I said, hey, I get it. You steal stuff, we steal stuff. Mm-hmm. All right. But I only steal things. This is me as director of NSA, and I'm quite candid about this in the book, all right?
Yeah.
We do steal stuff.
You are.
And I say, look, but we only steal stuff to keep our citizens free and to keep them safe. We do not steal stuff to make our citizens rich. And Ben, there are only four or five countries around the world who can say those sentences and have them be true, and they're all the usual suspects, the English-speaking democracies. So what we now have here is a country like China, whose cyber power is not the same as ours, that pretty much conducting what I would call unrestricted submarine warfare. Okay.
Yeah.
They
have no scruples.
They let their government sponsored activities steal things we do not allow ourselves to steal from other governments.
Yeah. Now, if China or Russia or North Korea were to attack us, are we capable of hitting back with equal or greater force?
We are. We have tools, all right? But the problem, Ben, is the cyber domain gives tremendous advantage to the offense.
Yeah.
And so even a less capable state can create great havoc here in the United States. Now, you gave a list of countries. You said Russia, China, and North Korea. Mm-hmm. I am actually less concerned about what I would call a near peer, China, for example, creating catastrophic damage here. The line I've used in some public speeches is, if the Chinese are turning off the lights east of the Mississippi, that's probably not the first thing the president's getting in his morning briefing. In other words, there's ugly stuff going down. I'm more concerned about
the main thing.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. I'm more concerned about the isolated, renegade, nothing to lose, let's roll the dice nation state, which is the other one you mentioned, North Korea. Or an Iran that's an extremist. And frankly, maybe even a Russia. That's what concerns me.
Well, you know, along those lines, I remember when the Sony hack happened, Shortly thereafter, their internet went out for about 10 hours. Would it be safe to assume that that probably wasn't an accident?
It would be safe to assume it wasn't an accident, but I would not automatically assume that that was done by the United States government, which has refused to confirm or deny its activities.
Well, yeah, I mean, they barely have working plumbing in North Korea.
I was going to say, yeah, and bringing the North Korean internet to its knees, probably not that dramatic a thing.
Yeah, yeah. President Obama recently said that he's going to try and close Guantanamo prison, and supposedly he's going to send a proposal to Congress. Is that just posturing?
No, it's not posturing. He's very sincere about it. And frankly, I have to admit, you know, the Bush administration pushed more people out of Guantanamo than the Obama administration.
Really?
So we were trying to reduce the population. Now, all that said, Ben, I'm a bit uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. All right. It looks as if the president is doing this based upon the electoral shot clock.
Yeah.
I want to get this done while I'm still president. I don't want him taking any crazy shots from midcourt just because the clock is running down.
Right.
I would also prefer that we not solve, that word's in quotes, this issue by creating a constitutional crisis. In other words, the president attempts to do it by executive order, even in the face of legislation that says no. And then finally, Ben, there's one other point. This president and President Bush have both said we're at war with al-Qaeda. That gives us the legal underpinning to actually go kill some of these people who threaten us. Ben, it also gives us the authority and the legitimacy to capture people who threaten us without ever putting them in front of a court of law. A lot of people view Guantanamo as lawless, right? It's not lawless.
Yeah, that is how the media portrays it.
We have several structures of law we can rely on. One is criminal law. The other is the law of armed conflict. And by the way, Ben, if President Obama brings some of these prisoners to the United States, some of them are still going to be forever prisoners. In other words, people were never going to try and people were never going to let loose. I actually think as part of a package solving Guantanamo, you can probably tell I'm less interested in the geography than I am in the broad approach. I think as part of a package with regard to Guantanamo might be a commitment that we actually are going to go out there and capture people as members of an opposing armed enemy force without this pre-existent requirement that we don't grab anybody unless we think we can put them in front of a judge in New York.
Yeah. There are also many people who call for closing of these so-called black sites, these secret prisons operated mostly in host countries outside the U.S. You have argued in the book that we need to empty them but not close them. If we're going to empty these prisons... Okay. Then what's the purpose of having
Sure, that was contemporary. That was my position in 06.
Okay.
All right. And I became director in May. The detention interrogation program was a pretty big elephant in the room. We needed a way forward. And what I said to the president eventually through Steve Hadley, the National Security Advisor.
Oh, yeah, he's been on the show.
Yeah. I said, Steve, we're not the nation's jailers. We're the nation's intelligence service. Most of the intelligence value of these guys has already bled off. I get it, Steve. It's not zero, but most of it has bled off. I want to pass these guys on. So on Labor Day weekend, 06, Ben, we shipped 14 prisoners to Guantanamo. But I said to Steve, but I don't want to close these places. I can't predict the future. We may want to put additional people in here to interrogate them. And in fact, Ben, over the next 2 years, I did put two people in those prisons. We drew down the number of interrogation techniques we would use. We went full Monty to the entire congressional oversight committees, and the president actually was quite public that we had done this. That was the state of affairs for the rest of the Bush administration. Then when President Obama becomes president, he makes the decision to close the black sites and to, frankly, not interrogate anyone under any regime other than the Army Field Manual. So you've got this step process. By the way, you know, I disagree with that, and I outlined in the book why I said to the incoming administration, you know, you might want to keep your options open. But let me say something that I say in the book that might surprise some of your listeners. All right, there is powerful continuity between the Bush and the Obama administration over most things when it comes to fighting terrorism. In fact, I would make the case, Ben, there was a bigger change between 43-1 and 43-2, President Bush's administrations, than there were between President Bush and President Obama.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I actually believe you. Well, you've made some real headlines in the past few days here, because you said that, you know, and today is, we're recording this on Super Tuesday.
We are.
You said if Donald Trump were elected, the military would not necessarily be obligated to follow certain orders of his that he has described. What is it that scares you the most about the idea of Donald Trump as commander in chief?
Well, here's how I've characterized it. And, you know, I try not to be a political person. So I'm asking you, I'm answering your question as a military professional. Yeah. All right. So number one, or a national security experience kind of guy.
Yeah.
All right. So number one, what I say is, if a President Trump governed consistent with some of the things he has said as candidate Trump, I would really be worried. I would be scared. All right. So that's one. Specifically, what candidate Trump has said is that he would put the families of terrorists at risk. In other words, he actually said he would kill the
families. He said he would kill families of terrorists. Which that's a war crime, right?
It is a war crime. It's consistent. It's inconsistent with the laws of armed conflict. It's inconsistent with the code of military ethics. And here was the punchline. I simply said on Bill Maher last Friday, I don't think my old friends would do it.
Yeah.
They just wouldn't carry it out.
Yeah.
Well, now Bill said, oh, it's a mutiny. I said, no, it's not a mutiny. It's not overthrowing the government. It's simply saying an unlawful order is not an order.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I hope that they wouldn't carry that out. Well, before we go, there's one aspect of your job that I have always wondered about personally. As a human being, what is it like to have the burden of keeping so many secrets? You can't confide in friends and family. You can't just come home and complain about work and vent. You know, perhaps in terms of interpersonal relationships, there are probably people who aren't in the system who will never truly know you.
Yeah.
Does that sort of isolation take a toll?
It takes a toll, but it's not just on me. And I try to point this out. It's everybody who takes these oaths of secrecy. Look. Espionage is truly American. Our first spy master was George Washington, all right?
Yeah.
But espionage requires a degree of secrecy that we are uncomfortable with broadly in American society. And so it does create great stresses on the people who are required to kind of live in this high torque position between a very transparent society and a very secretive enterprise. And it takes a personal toll. And that's what I try to describe. What I try to describe is it takes a toll because these people aren't different from you and me.
Yeah,
they share the same values, and yet they freely accept this additional burden in order to do what it is we ask them to do for us. That's what I try to describe in the book.
And it takes a toll on families, too, I'm sure.
Yeah,
I can only imagine. Well, you know, we'll end on a lighter note. Okay. Do you ever watch James Bond movies?
I watch James Bond movies. I love the scenery. It's fun. Has nothing to do with the old job I had. If you're really interested, I watch Homeland.
Oh, okay.
And I like Homeland.
Is that a little more realistic?
And here's my summary.
Yeah.
All the stuff in the foreground of Homeland, that's all wrong.
Okay.
You pull out a cell phone at CIA headquarters in Langley, you're going to end up with your face down in the concrete, all right?
No cell phones at Langley?
Oh, God, no.
Okay.
But,
good to know.
But Ben, all the stuff in the background, focus on mission, the camaraderie, kind of a bit of isolation, the obsession with getting the job done, that rings pretty true.
Yeah. James Bond, total BS?
Look, James Bond is fun.
I kind of got it.
No,
okay.
No.
Okay. Martini shaken or stirred? How do you like it?
A fine white wine, please.
Very nice. Well, the book is called Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. General Michael Hayden, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Ben.
My thanks again to General Michael Hayden for coming on the show, and you can follow him on Twitter at Gen M Hayden. That's GenMHayden. I'll also include Amazon links in the show notes and on our website, so you can order his new book, Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. Or if you prefer to listen to the audiobook, you can actually download that for free through that special trial offer just for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. Don't forget to subscribe to Kick-Ass Politics and leave us a review on iTunes. That helps a bunch with our podcast rankings. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. Or click on the donate button on our website at kickasspolitics.com. Your support is very much appreciated. Follow us on Twitter at KAPolitics or visit Kickass Politics on Facebook. And while you're there, recommend Kickass Politics to your friends on your social media. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, threats, and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com. On the next episode, from birther conspiracies and 9/11 truthers to the wild speculation around the recent death of Justice Antonin Scalia, I'll be debunking wingnut conspiracy theories with my guest, Dr. Michael Shermer, founder and editor of Skeptic Magazine. Dr. Shermer will explain the psychology behind conspiracy thinking and how much of our predisposition toward conspiracies is actually a holdover from the completely rational survival instincts of our caveman ancestors. He'll talk about what kind of people buy into conspiracy theories, and I guarantee that some of his answers will surprise you. He'll also raise alarming concerns about the recent trend of irrational conspiracy theories going mainstream, as media figures like Jesse Ventura and Alex Jones perpetuate the cycle of delusion and paranoia increasingly affects American politics. Plus, we'll cover the moon landing, anti-vaxxers, Sandy Hook, the Denver airport, the death of Vince Foster, the Illuminati, the Bilderbergers, Area 51, chemtrails, and much, much, much more. When we put those and other wingnut conspiracy theories to the ultimate test, with my guest, Skeptic Magazine's Dr. Michael Shermer, on the next podcast. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. This podcast may not be reproduced without express written permission. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.